Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
So I'd like to slop a little. Can we do a little slopping up?
I love it. Get sloppy with me.
I need to know you a little better. You're like...
Did
you're
we just become best friends?
I think you're like line over the line.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Illegal News. I am not Sarah Longwell, but I am her best friend. I'm JVL.
Wait, you're JVL and you're not Sarah?
I know.
Uh-oh.
Like Sarah Longwell, I am not a lawyer. Unlike Sarah Longwell, I crushed the LSATs and did get into law school. So I could have become... I'm basically 1/20th of a lawyer, which is really exciting for me. And I am joined today by Andrew Weissman, who's become an absolute pro guest hosting the Illegal News. Andrew is not just a real lawyer, a 100% lawyer, but a very storied lawyer, spent 20 years at the Department of Justice. He was general counsel at the FBI. He has a podcast now on MSN Now called Main Justice. And on May 19th, he has a book coming out, Liar's Kingdom, How to Stop Trump's Deceit and Save America. Andrew, I will just repeat what I said to you in the green room. I am dying to read this book, and the minute I'm done, I want to tape a show with you and Sarah because I have so many questions. You did a little teaser with Sarah about Liar's Kingdom and how forward-looking it is and how looking at how other countries have tried to authoritarian-proof their legal systems and...
Right.
You know what? Can I just put a quarter in the machine before we start?
Yes, but I then have a question. Okay, this is going to be like quid pro quo time. I have a question for you.
Okay,
you go first.
So what are we to do if it turns out that there are reforms that can be made that would make authoritarianism harder to execute in America, but that the execution of those reforms is actually not possible because the various legal and constitutional mechanisms either are too ossified to work or never actually worked in the first place. So like, for instance, I'll give you one of my raps is that like impeachment, it turns out, is a failed mechanism.
Doesn't work.
And people
Doesn't work.
Say, well, the Constitution provides a remedy. But this is like, you know, if saying the remedy is, and then you fly. Well, it turns out people can't fly. So saying that it's a remedy doesn't make it so.
Totally. That is a great question. And just to be clear, it's not like I have a silver bullet, like, oh, this is the answer and it's going to solve
everything.
It sounds
so good. When you were talking about the different laws that other countries have about like lying about election results, which is...
So I did something that Ruth Bader Ginsburg was a big fan of, which is, you know, stop looking at your navel and look overseas and see what other people have done because they may have... a good answer. It reminds me of Nicole Wallace said that when she was working for President Bush, that one of the first instincts he had was to say, well, what have my predecessors done in situations like this? With the idea that, you know what? Like, why are we reinventing the wheel? Maybe there's something that we can learn from that. And it doesn't mean there is. So I deliberately, my solution is not, oh, well, let's just change the Constitution. I mean, of course, that's a solution. It's just that's not going to happen in our lifetime, I don't think, or it's not as realistic a solution. It's also for the reason that my book doesn't say, well, I just think we need to have a better education system and we need to teach civics. Of course we do. Of course that's the case. But my analogy is like, that is like the Titanic hitting the iceberg. And the captain says, what we need to do is we need to invest in radar better. We need more money in radar. It's like, not the time, not the place. Of course it's true, but I'm just, it's like, so I wanted to think of something practical that can be done and that also we could look to see how it has worked and how other countries have implemented it. So I give a lot of different models And then I try and figure out what might pass constitutional muster here so that we don't have to be in a situation where the solution is, let's just pass a constitution. So, you know, much more on that to come. But when do I get to ask you a question?
You can do it right now. But first, I would just remind people that you can get Liar's Kingdom right now if you pre-order it at Barnes & Noble or Amazon or Bookshop. I think it's bookshop.org, bookshop.com. Yep, one of those is the great indie books place, which
it
is where I try to buy things. And I can only not tell you what it is now because my search bar auto-populates it because I go there so often.
Yeah. And so the other is that I have signed, because I also, by the way, am a big fan of supporting when I can, independent bookstores. And so the Chatham bookstore in Chatham, New York, will have signed copies. So will Politics and Prose, a very well-known bookstore in Washington, D.C. So they have signed copies. So anyway, that's enough of the plug of, but just to be clear, it is trying to deal with, like, what can we do? How do we get out of where we are? And what are the systemic reforms that could be implemented?
You know, I like to think of it, Andrew, as a companion book to How to Eat an Elephant, a forthcoming book by Sarah Longwell, which are both really action-oriented, forward-looking books about how to save the Republic.
And I'm, by the way, of course, dying to read her book as well. But one thing I will say is we realize both of us are dealing very much with a new sort of informational environment that sort of features a lot in my book is sort of like why certain older solutions that we have sort of fallen back on are not working right now. And it's like how to deal with that. And she is, it's so funny. We're sort of, that's sort of the context and the backdrop for sort of two very different takes about what can we do? How do we get out of this in ways that are more useful and timely than let's just teach civics.
All right. Ask your question and then we'll get into it.
Why on God's green earth would you put yourself through taking the LSATs and then not go to law school?
Well, you know, listeners of the Secret Podcast may know this story. Other people won't. The reason is because I was in the process of getting rejected from all 23 of the medical schools I had applied to.
So that, wait, does that mean that you also took
yes. Yes.
So you just love.
I took the MCAT and the LSAT. Look, I spent 2 years of my life preparing for the MCAT and I did like, okay, just okay. Not good enough to get me into medical school with my grades. And I spent a week and a half prepping for the LSAT. And like I think I went like 172 or something and got into a couple top 10 law schools. At which
so you're
point
natural.
At which point it was like the old Mark Twain, is the Mark Twain line or an Oscar Wilde line about I wouldn't want to belong to any club that would have me. And I was like, wait a minute, hold on. So I can't get into any of the worst three medical schools in America, even though I've spent my entire life trying to become a doctor, but top 10 law schools will take me? That's bullshit. What is this? I'm not going to go become a journalist. I'm going to go be a writer. So that is the short version.
Okay. That's a good answer. That's a good answer.
I mean,
it is. I mean, you know, law school, I loved law school, but I think I might be a sort of minority of that. So I just, I hated taking those tests. I hated studying for them. I just couldn't imagine voluntarily putting myself through that. But anyway, apparently you're a natural.
No, well, the LSAT was a fun test compared to the MCAT.
That's what I remember. I remember saying, LSAT, I want to do that again.
Well, it's logic puzzles. The LSAT is like an extended version of the New York Times games. App. And anyway, we don't need to do that. All right, let's get into it. Okay. I want to start today with the Michael Flynn settlement with the Department of Justice this week. The Department of Justice is giving Michael Flynn $1.25 million. Listeners may remember that Flynn is the retired three-star Army Lieutenant General who is Trump's first NSA for 4 minutes, 3.5 minutes, hard to say how long back in the front, the first term. I think he resigned after 24 days. He had been back channeling with Russia, and he in 2017 pleaded guilty to intentionally making false statements to the FBI. Then he was never sentenced, and Trump pardoned him in 2020. And now the Department of Justice is giving him tax taxpayer money for, I don't understand, like wrongful prosecution to a crime he admitted committing. Andrew, how does this work? Because it just seems like bribery or something like that. Like the president is my friend, and so my friend will use the government to give me money.
So I'm going to focus on the Department of Justice in my answer, because I really think that's where the issue is. So this is this settlement was Michael Flynn had sued the department. Let's assume that, you know, here's somebody who thinks they have some claim, and lots of people can sue the Department of Justice. Sometimes they're right, sometimes they're wrong, but I don't really fault the lawsuit. It's the response to the lawsuit. So the Department of Justice, my question to Pam Bondi and Todd Blanche, and if we ever get out of this and have a normal administration and a normal attorney general, my question to that normal attorney general is, could you please separate what happened here with theft? What is the difference between your going into the United States Treasury and stealing $1.25 million? And the reason I say that is to make this a legitimate, quote unquote, settlement, there would have to be a good faith belief that he has a meritorious argument and that there might be some downside in litigating this. In other words, a lot of times you might be like, well, you know what? I think we're going to win. I think the other side might win, but, you know, let's try and resolve this. But here, I don't see the downside of having taken it to court. And the issues here seem so completely one-sided that I really do not understand how you justify this as anything but theft. As you said, this is something that Michael Flynn admitted under oath he did, which was lied to the FBI. Now, he then, just to be fair, he then moved to withdraw his guilty plea. There was lots and lots of litigation back and forth, and that ultimately ended up with Donald Trump.
The technical term for that in blacks is oopsie, right? I did an oopsie.
Yeah, it's very hard to do an oopsie when you're pleading guilty under oath with a lawyer in court, and the court asks you whether you did this.
From the Latin oopsicus mistakicus.
Yeah, so that must have been on the LSAT. No wonder you did so well on that. That there was that whole oopsie part. I don't think I did. It's like a whole career missed.
I'm taking your show from you.
Okay. It's perfect. Okay. But here's another thing. So, could we just remember before Michael Flynn was criminally charged and pled guilty before he said he's not guilty? He was the, as you said, for like Liz Truss, he was sort of the, he was the national security advisor for, like, you could compare it to the head of Cabbage, you know, like as to how long he was there. And it was for a very short time. But why? Because Mike Pence went on air and sort of vouched for Michael Flynn and said, you know, no, this hadn't happened. No, Michael Flynn had not had these communications with the Russian ambassador. And all of the reporting was that Mike Pence was like, oh my God, I repeated that because you told me that's what happened and it's not true. And that's why he was fired. All of this, like, there is such amnesia. Donald Trump fired Michael Flynn because by all accounts, it was because he had lied to the sitting vice president of the United States. So now the Department of Justice is giving him $1.25 million. I didn't realize that conduct, that behavior is something that you get $1.25 million for. And just to be clear, when you've got this sort of collusive settlement, which is what, to my mind, this appears to be, we also know that Donald Trump has said he is going to be bringing, and it wants some, I can't remember his number, keeps on going up, but whether it's 10 million or 10 billion, it doesn't really matter because he controls both sides of the equation.
230 million, I believe, is the current figure he's seeking.
Oh, okay. Well, that's so low. And just be clear, that's our money. Our money. And that would be because there was a court-ordered search that was done, which mm-hmm. meant that the court approved the probable cause. Even Judge Cannon didn't say there was selective or vindictive prosecution there. That's a pretty big deal. And so to me, I don't think that Pam Bondi and Todd Blanch are understanding that there is going to be a forum that they have to answer to what is the good faith belief as to why they're doing this.
So what is the forum where they have to answer that question?
Well, the next administration can look into this as, one, there's an ethics issue. Remember, they represented Ooh. Donald Trump individually, and they have to be looking out for the interests of the public, not for the interests of Donald Trump. And so the question is going to be, what's the good faith belief to have done this? There's not going to be a career person, I think, who's going to be saying, oh, this is a really good idea. I mean, these kinds of claims are fought by the government all the time for good yeah. reason. Just to be clear, you have cases where the government may bring a criminal case and lose at trial, and still they wouldn't have to pay money because the issue is they still had a good faith belief to go forward. And so this is so... from all accounts, it looks so far from that. So they're going to have to answer, I think, both ethically. And as I said, and this may be a little bit fanciful, but the issue is, if there is not a good faith belief, why isn't this theft of government money? I mean, who are they to say to take this money and give it to somebody?
Well, I mean, I suppose the answer to that is, well, the law provides for all of this, and that the law assumes that people wouldn't participate in the legal theft of government money. But, you know, we were on the honor system.
I hear you. I'm not sure. I was thinking about this beforehand, and I was thinking of using the phrase legal theft. I'm not sure if you cannot show that there is a valid basis to have settled this and a good faith belief. And just remember, what you're going to compare that to is you're going to talk about all of the other cases that the government has been saying, no, 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 we are not paying. And you're going to need to say, well, why here? And why are you doing it here? And why is this just not doing it because you like the person or it's somebody who Donald Trump likes? And that to me really is either going to be a legal issue or an ethical issue or both. And as I said, I do think, well, this is bad. I think it is the harbinger of more to come, because we know that Donald Trump wants to do this. And for all we know, this was a public lawsuit, so we know what happened. But we don't know, and we may eventually learn if there's a clean administration that comes in, whether this has been happening with other people doing this without bringing a lawsuit. In other words, just having a private agreement with the Department of Justice right. where they give out money and we just don't know.
This seems to be the governmental version of what Trump did with his defamation and libel suits against media organizations right before he came into office, right? So he...
Yes, he but even, filed even these worse. Suits which even were, worse, yeah.
Well, even worse, but essentially the same thing. So when he sued ABC and 60 Minutes and CBS, rather, and then they settled these ludicrous suits that they absolutely right. would have won at trial, what that was basically just a legalized form of bribery, right? I mean, it was an innovative, I think, insight on the part of Trump, where he realized, I would like to shake these people down. That's not legal. But a legal way is to file a lawsuit, which they are then happy to settle with me, because this way they're paying, right? It's a way to make the payoff totally legal and above board. This is that too.
It's sort of a bribery slash extortion. Like, you know, right. like you could imagine maybe CBS is in a different position because of everything we've seen, which is they seem supine, let's just say. Right. But let's assume ABC was like, we didn't really want to pay, but they sort of feel like they were extorted to pay. The reason this is worse is because here they don't have to worry about that, because it's not like Pam Bondi is sitting there going, oh, I really don't want to pay. She's just like, how many zeros do I add to the check?
Yeah. I mean, this is just to reward apparatchiks.
Yeah, exactly. So I really do think my sort of educated guess is that this has happened, but in situations where there's not been a public lawsuit. And other people have received money in situation, and it could be for situations that are equally not meritorious.
I would love to think that we're going to get actual accountability on this stuff, but man,
this is where I did go to law school. I'm still an institutionalist. And well, I'll tell you a quick story. The first time I was on MS Now during a break, Claire McCaskill turned to me and she goes, "You're so naive." Because I was sort of starry-eyed and thinking, well, you know, the reason I think I just have that is like, because if I don't, it's like, we're so screwed. So I just feel like I have to have some thing to hold on to that.
Embrace the darkness, Andrew. We're going to put the doors on, put on some Jim Morrison. This is the end. Honestly, I almost laughed when you said, well, there could be some ethics investigations.
I know, just to be clear,
ethics.
Not now. I know ethics. You're sitting like, you and Claire McCaskill should form a little club of like, oh my God, you think he was naive then. It's gotten worse. By the way, there's not going to be an ethics investigation now, although.
No, but even that.
You know, that Pam Bondi is proposed this rule for bar associations to have to sort of take a second seat to the Department of Justice, so that if a bar association is looking at a lawyer's conduct at the Department of Justice, she wants it to be that, yes, you can do that, but only after we do it, which means they sort of have a kill switch on that. And I know lots of people, we've talked about it here, we've talked about it on Main Justice and lots of places. And there have been, I think, over 30,000 people who have weighed in on that proposed rule against it. Seeing that they're trying to remove that ethics inquiry that could be done. But even if there's not an ethics inquiry now, which there could be one in the future. So
fingers crossed.
you're just like, uh-huh. Next topic.
Sure. All right. We're going to move on to Jack Smith in a minute. But before that, got to have a word from our friends at Superpower. This show is sponsored by Superpower. If you've been leaving the doctor lately and been told, oh, you're fine, or just drink more water, but didn't get any helpful advice, Superpower is here to help. Superpower sends a licensed professional to your home, or you can visit a nearby lab. It's one simple blood draw with over 100 biomarkers, which is way more than what you usually get. And it unlocks a real understanding of your body. Their app includes detailed information on your heart, liver, thyroid, hormones, metabolism, vitamin and mineral levels, and even environmental toxins. So from disease prevention to treating that annoying brain fog or simply optimizing my gym game, Superpower is the most comprehensive and advanced system out there. Superpower doesn't just give you a one-time snapshot. It tracks your results over your lifetime. Each test builds on the last, so you can actually see progress year after year instead of starting over every January. They have an on-demand care team to answer questions as well, instead of waiting to see your doctor or Googling what things mean on your own. Not recommended. In the future, we're going to laugh about how our healthcare was all reactive to the problems that occur. Superpower is here to make proactive healthcare a reality and accessible to everyone. Learn your true biological age and organ age that you can track over time. Make this the year you stop guessing about your health with Superpower. Not only did Superpower reduce their price to just $199, but for a limited time, our listeners get an additional $20 off with code illegalnews. Head to superpower.com and use code illegalnews at checkout for $20 off your membership. After you sign up, they'll ask how you heard about them, so make sure to mention this podcast to support the show. Let's move to Jack Smith. We're going to be all special counsels all the time. The House Judiciary Committee has been conducting an oversight investigation related to Jack Smith's two investigations of Trump, one related to the attempt to overturn the 2020 election, the other to the classified documents that Trump took with him after he left office. We've had some developments this week. Can you tell me about the committee's decision not to call Smith to testify yet and the letter that they Democrats sent to DOJ?
You know, why they have not called Jack Smith? Well, first, Jack Smith has testified publicly, right? So, you know, I mean, in the sense that that is, they first did a little preview and then he testified publicly. So that's sort of one. I actually discussed a lot of this, I think, with Sarah, that the one quibble I have with you is I don't view this as an investigation because they're not doing any of the things that you would do if you were investigating. So you would start by figuring out what has already been looked at, and then you'd look at more things. They just have not done this sort of all of the sort of groundwork that you would do to investigate. But do you want to talk about, it sounds like what you want to sort of narrow, sort of focus in on is this issue of the letter that I think it's Jamie Raskin wrote this letter to the Department of Justice, which I think is super, super fascinating.
Pertinent to certain business interests is the phrase that caught my eye.
Yes. Okay. So this is an interesting story, but there's a little bit of like, it's like discussing Hamlet without Hamlet, which is this is what the reporting is, but we don't actually have the key documents to ourselves look at. So there's a lot of sort of like, this is what people have said. We can't sort of say, oh, let's put up on the screen and let's talk about the exact wording. The Department of Justice did, I think, what's that legal term you used? An oopsie?
Yeah, oopsicus mysticus.
Oopsicus. Yeah. I need to get my Latin.
I know. Well, you're working on French. You know. Yeah. There's only so many hours in a day, Andrew.
I know. It's just, but you're like a Renaissance man with like all of these different pieces.
If I was a real Renaissance man, I'd be rocking a scarf like you are.
It's really cold here. So we don't have the actual underlying documents, but here's what we know. The Department of Justice was turning over documents to the so-called January 6th, you know, investigation of the investigators, essentially. This is sort of the Republican-controlled investigation, which is like, we want to talk to Bill Clinton, we want to talk to Hillary Clinton, but we're not going to talk to all these sort of obvious people like the actual FBI and prosecutors who did the investigation on all sorts of things. We're not going to talk about, all sorts of people with relevant information. But the Department of Justice did turn over documents that we can see that have to do with Jack Smith subpoenaing telephone records of members of Congress. And those are ones that we actually can look at. And you can see what they did and why they did it and all of the internal permissions they talked about needing to get, as well as like why it's such a standard thing to do, because you need to know sort of about the timeline of like who spoke to who and when. And it's, I found it incredibly damning looking at those documents, sort of how many people the White House was contacting either on January 6th or in the lead up to January 6th to get members of Congress on board with what I viewed as obstructing the peaceful transfer of power. So that's sort of one piece, but they also turned over documents that did not relate to the members of Congress in their telephone records. They turned over, in their infinite wisdom, but it clearly was a mistake, internal documents that have been reported to be about Jack Smith saying that two things. One, in the Mar-a-Lago case, that some of the documents were so sensitive that only six people in the U.S. government were permitted to have access to them. That's how sensitive the documents were that were then taken to Mar-a-Lago. So that's sort of one interesting point. And remember, this was kept at Mar-a-Lago after
the bathroom,
Yes, and at bathroom, ballroom. But also, he's not president, right? This is not like he did it while he's president. This is like he's now citizen Trump. But the second is that the reporting is that they determined that there was a business reason that they could connect as to, so sort of the issue was sort of why was, and that people were all speculating, it's why was he taking certain documents? What was it that he found interesting? Was it to have something on certain people? Was it curiosity? Was it something that would help him in business? You know, because he seems to be very, you know, there's a whole, we just talked about, we spent a lot of time talking about money in our, when we were talking about Michael Flynn and about Donald Trump using sort of his powers to get more money. And by the way, we touched the tip of the iceberg because there's just so much grift and graft going on. And so that is what was, what the documents purport to say, is that this was Jack Smith saying that we've actually have some theory or figured out how at least some of the documents can be explained as potential business interests. What we don't know is which documents and what business interests, because we don't have the actual documents. I sort of been scouring to see whether those are anywhere public, and those don't appear to be public. There's more to the story, though, which is Judge Cannon had said that nobody can talk about the Mar-a-Lago case, and Jack Smith cannot release the second volume of his report about the Mar-a-Lago case. And I'm issuing an order to that effect, and no one should talk. No one should, anything that's not already public cannot be made public. So there's a whole issue about, even though it was a mistake, did the Department of Justice just violate her order? Which, by the way, if this was Jack Smith doing it, he would, like, there is no question in my mind that he would be like in front of her and there'd be like contempt proceedings. Now, of course, to be fair, I mean, this obviously was inadvertent. There's, you know, this is not something the Department of Justice, they were obviously.
I'm sure Justice Cannon would have taken that into account had Jack Smith's office done it inadvertently.
Yeah. No. It's like, you know, we were taking into account the 11th Circuit that oversees her. They would take into account because they've already reversed her twice, and this would be like another trip.
You know, we do have a couple Supreme Court vacancies coming up, Andrew.
God, you really are good at pushing my buttons, because, like,
yeah, that's right.
You know, I just get triggered pretty easily, but I'm like trying to control myself. I know. These are all dress rehearsals of the people who, I don't know how they wake up and look at themselves in the mirror.
Hi, Uncle Laser here. America's built on fast cars, fast food, and even faster women. Photo Casino's built in America. You know what they're fast at? Fast cash prize redemption. You see, only Moto is U.S. owned and operated. Moto. It's American made. That's who we are, and that's who we care about. Play for free at Moto.us.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Okay, but this story gets worse. So not only has the Department of Justice now sort of inadvertently leaked this, and there's a court order that they're not supposed to be releasing it. Nobody is supposed to be releasing anything publicly. But who has now tweeted something about this? Todd Blanche. And Todd Blanche, and there's so much to say about this, but Todd Blanche has said, well, Jack Smith is a proven liar. And let me just underscore his word. Proven liar. And so you can't believe a word he's saying. And, you know, this is all made up, and he's just gotten a vendetta, and there's no truth at all. Oh,
I have the full quote here if you'd like it, Andrew.
Let's go to the videotape.
Jack Smith is a proven liar, consistent with these fake accusations from his failed vendetta against the president. The media should stop slopping up the trash dropped by the Democrats on their path to misleading the American public.
Okay, so I'd like to slop a little. Is it okay? Can we do a little slopping up?
I love it.
Okay. So
get sloppy with me.
Okay, so number... I need to know you a little better. You're like...
Did
you're
we
like,
just become best friends?
I think you're like line over the line. Could Todd Blanche just please explain to me what he means by proven? What do you mean Jack Smith is a proven liar? I didn't see. I think we missed the. Was that a criminal case or a civil case? I mean, or is that the case that they're going to bring as a retaliation step against him? But like he is not a proven liar. Period. The end. And this is the Deputy Attorney General of the United States saying that.
Well, words don't have meaning, Andrew. You can just say things.
I know that you made the mistake of releasing this document, but like then to lash out this way. But here's this to go back to my quaint view about ethics. Todd Blanche should not be saying anything about this because he was the president's defense lawyer. I have served under Republican and Democratic administrations, up one side and down the other. You cannot have a role in cases where you were involved as a private attorney. Period. The end. You are recused. What
you conflicted
is he doing?
Out, right?
Yeah. What is he doing speaking about this when he was on the defense side in private practice? Like it is. I mean, this is just, I know it's like, it's not exhibit A, it's exhibit like, you know, ZZZ to where we are in this Department of Justice, but it is, there's no ethics, there's no law. I mean, it fits so much with what we talked about in terms of Michael Flynn, but this is one where I just was like, his response to me was just proof positive again of the depths to which the Department of Justice has gone.
It's wild. But like I said, we're going to have a couple vacancies on the high court. And, you know, between Emile Beauvais and Eileen Cannon and Todd Blanche, it's going to be a real hot stove. A lot to do.
Yes.
We're going to circle back at the end of the show for one last special counsel segment with Robert Mueller.
Yes.
Before we do, I want to talk about two Pentagon things. First is we got a decision, I think it was Federal District Court in D.C., about the Pentagon's attempts to exclude press members from briefings. District Court ruled that this was unconstitutional. Can you just, quick reminder for people here, how we got here?
Sure. So the press does not have a right to be in the Pentagon per se. You know, the Pentagon could say we don't have a press room, we're not making our locations open to the public. That would be fine. But that's not their position. Their position is that they allow the press in and they give credentials to the press to cover news. And just to be clear, that helps the public, but it also helps the Pentagon. It's a way of they have transparency with the public. We were just talking about the FBI and before we started about sort of that's just a routine thing that happens in Washington. So once you have decided to open your doors to the press, what you cannot do is you cannot base that opening of the doors on viewpoint discrimination. You can't say, well, you know what? It's not just I like this person. It's like this person's going to say things that are positive about me. And so they can come. But this person who's going to say something critical or going to ask demanding questions, they cannot come. And so you can't have viewpoint discrimination. The other is that there has to be a fair process if you are going to take action with respect to some journalist. You can't just do it with no reason. There has to be some due process in how you actually go about making that decision. And so here, there's a number of good aspects to this story, which is kind of nice because we just spent time talking about two really depressing things. Here, the New York Times and a New York Times journalist sued, saying that it is unfair that we have, that you are saying that if we don't agree to essentially all of your terms and conditions, we are going to be barred from the press room. In other words, we have to be compliant with what essentially everything you want. And the thing is that the New York Times and the New York Times Reporter were not the only ones who said that this Pentagon policy that was sort of viewpoint-based was problematic. And CNN said the same thing. Fox said the same thing. And this is one where this is really goose gander, which is that, you know, you don't want to be in a Democratic administration and having, right, having them say, you know what, I don't want to have, you know, conservative journalists there because, you know, they're going to be critical of what we're doing. And so it's just part of what it means to be in America is like, you know, you may not like getting tough questions, but then don't take the job. And so you, I thought it was wonderful that so many times when we were talking about law firms or universities, well, now there's new reporting about the same things that seems to be happening with respect to medical schools. I know you don't care because none of them accepted you.
Too soon, Andrew. Too soon.
Okay. Sorry. I didn't want to trigger you. Okay. So but let's just move on. Okay. So are you okay? Can we? Okay, well, I'll keep talking now just because you need
two decades of therapy. I'm fine.
So take a deep breath. Deep breath.
Yeah, give me my breath. Affirmations.
Okay.
Namaste.
So what's lovely about this is that reputable or large sort of traditional media organizations, whether you think they're reputable or not, joined together and all sort of saw this as a problem and said that it's viewpoint discrimination, and the policies that the Pentagon is putting forth are just way too vague. Are going to allow the Pentagon to use it to really discriminate improperly against news organizations, whether, you know, liberal this time, conservative next time, or anything in between. And Judge Paul Friedman struck it down and said that this violates the First Amendment and the Fifth Amendment. He joins a number of federal judges of all political backgrounds who have found that this administration has once again violated the Constitution.
So DOD's response is, okay, we're going to build an annex. And it's not in the Pentagon. It's over there. You journalists can go in there. Is that going to pass muster? This feels like those free speech zones. Do you remember like 2004, we had at the Democratic and Republican conventions, everybody was worried about protests and stuff like that. And so they built like little cages that were free speech zones. It was like, oh, you would like to protest? It's absolutely welcome. We just lock you in a cage over there to do your protesting. It feels a little bit like that.
It depends how they do it. The location is not really the issue. There are two issues that Judge Friedman found. One, if you don't change your policies about what is prohibited and what is not prohibited, make it clear, it is too vague and thus has a chilling effect on the right. First Amendment. The second is viewpoint discrimination. You can have viewpoint discrimination, and whether it is in room A or room B is not really the issue. You cannot have viewpoint discrimination anywhere. And so to me, it'll be interesting to see how they implement it. But once they are making any location open to the press, They cannot be saying the New York Times no, Fox News yes. Just to take an example. And by the way, did you catch in the decision the quote unquote journalists who are now getting credentialed by the Pentagon?
I didn't see it in the decision, but I've followed this. It's wild. A lot of foreign news agencies.
So one of them would be the very famed journalist. I'm sure you read a lot of his stuff. That would be Matt Gaetz. Are you reading a lot of his journalism? Yeah, I've been reading about his stuff in the
always trust a guy with a giant forehead.
Yeah, so that's one. The other is the famed journalist. She very, very prolific writer, Laura Loomer.
You know, Andrew, one of my unpopular views is that Laura Loomer is often a voice of reason in Trump 2.0. By the standards of Trump 2.0, Laura Loomer is almost a responsible person.
Okay, I'm going to be like, this is going to be my no comment.
Just saying.
Well, how about this?
It's all relative. Okay, the scale is sliding.
So let me give you, JL, like, let me give you one more journalist, because I know that you have to be following him.
Sure.
Mr. Lindell, the CEO.
Oh, yeah. The MyPillow people. Yeah.
Yeah. Love those guys. You've been reading his journalism for years, yeah. I assume.
I mean, that's where all the real news is.
Yeah. So they're all credentialed.
Sure.
And so
why not?
Just to be clear, they're the credentialed people who the Pentagon said, well, yes, because they're going to, and I'm paraphrasing, but it's like they're going to be with the program, right? They're going to promote what this administration wants. That is exactly what you cannot do under the First Amendment. And so that's where I did think it was a sign that in the media organizations, it was nice to see Fox standing with the New York Times and CNN, especially when we're in an age where CBS, as I said, seems to be just completely supine.
I mean, you know, just to put a bow on this, Fox has, I believe, joined with the other organizations in refusing to have Pete Hegseth on its air since this. CBS is putting together a big interview package with Hegseth as we speak. Oliver Darcy reported that earlier this week. You know, there it is. Okay, the other piece. Oh, I'm sorry. Let me do my transition the Sarah Longwell way. Okay. The second piece of Pentagon-related news.
God, that's good.
I'm working on it. So the Anthropic thing. So Anthropic, the AI company behind Claude, had been targeted by the Justice Department with what is essentially the death penalty, being designated as a supply chain risk, which would mean that Anthropic could not do business with any company that does business with the government, which is everybody. Not actually everybody, but a lot of people. This was a weird thing because it was almost self-evidently not true, because the Pentagon just wanted something from Anthropic and said, if you don't give us this thing, then we will designate you as a supply chain risk. But either they are a supply chain risk or they're not. I find this interesting for like three different reasons, but I just wanted to put a quarter in the machine with you and ask what you think this means. Do you think the courts are going to allow DOD to do this to Anthropic? This is just a temporary stay, right? This isn't a real decision. Where does this go? And am I over torqued on this? Is this a smaller thing than I think?
So the answer is no, you're not.
Okay.
This is one of the cases that I am fascinated by on multiple levels. Mary and I actually in Main Justice talked about the complaint precisely because we found this so interesting. Let me just give you the two levels that I'm watching this on. One level is just very much this idea that the United States government is browbeating is the polite term, but is basically holding a gun to their head saying, you will agree to how we want to use Claude, your invention, your AI invention, that you are going to make it available to us and you are going to have to agree to our using it in two ways. The two ways I'll talk about in a second, because that's the larger, more interesting issue in my mind. And if you don't agree to permitting us to use this under a contract with you in these two ways, we are going to designate you, as you said, a supply chain risk. And that means it may not kill you, but it's going to like maim and amputate, you know, one or both legs. I mean, it's hugely devastating consequences. And it is so palpable that they're not a supply chain risk because, as Anthropic said in their complaint, the government's position is we want to use you more. Your tool is right. Really, really useful. But if you don't let us use it more, we're going to say it's because you're a terrible company and you're a risk to our national security. So you got to pick a lane. It can't be both of those things. So the judge who heard the case said that this is a violation of Anthropic's First Amendment protections, and you can't retaliate against them for saying things that are against the government's position. And it is, as you said, it is a temporary stay, but it's a stay nonetheless. The federal judge in California has given Anthropic and the other side a time period to appeal. She has put on hold her decision so that the government can appeal it. Very responsible thing to do. I think this is such a palpably frivolous case because, as you said, it's like they either are a supply chain risk or they're not. And what is right. their evidence going to be of them being a supply chain risk when the government's saying we want to use your services? The sin is that you wouldn't let us use them more, not that you're a risk. So the entire theory here doesn't work. So I don't see how. But I think that's sort of that's sort of one level. I think the story is really this other level, which is what are the two ways that Anthropic said that we will not agree if you are going to contract with us. You don't have to contract with us, but if you want to contract with us, we're not agreeing that you can use our tool in these two ways. These are the fascinating things. So one is you cannot use Claude to identify targets of places and people to kill overseas without human intervention. In other words, right. like we're going to have machine.
Basically.
We're going to have yes. this Claude determine who gets killed, when they get killed, where they get killed without humans being involved. And this is what's so remarkable. First of all, who's thinking that's a good idea? Like even if Claude could do that, who's thinking, I think that's a great idea?
Maximum lethality, Andrew. They're not going to put up with your woke ideas about having to have bags of meat sitting between the robots and the bad guys.
Okay. So second, who would know more about the functionality of Claude? You said you did really well on the LSAT. So here's a logic question. If you had to find out the most information, the most reliable information about the capabilities of Claude, would you go to the Department of Defense and Pete Hegseth, or would you go to the company that created Claude?
I mean, I'd just go to Donald Trump. He took a cognitive test and the doctors told him that nobody had ever scored as high as he had on it. And in fact, most people never finished the test and he did all of the answers because he has all the cognitives.
So this probably explains the sort of the medical exam.
Results. This is, again, just didn't do great on MCAT.
I'm not quite understanding how, maybe that was a medical question. So I understand why that you didn't, so that would be wrong. And so this is what Anthropic said about this use. Leave aside whether, like, let's get your mind around that you're like, oh, this is a great idea. I think it's a wonderful thing to have computers decide all this. This is what Anthropic says in its complaint. Claude can't do it. It wasn't created to do it. It hasn't been tested to do it. So, like, so what do you mean you want us to agree that you can use it for something that it can't do and hasn't been tested to do? Do, do you think maybe if this bad idea, even if you got around to thinking it's a good idea, maybe you should use an AI program that's built for it and tested for it? I mean, because we're only talking about, you know, war with a foreign country and life and death issues. So that's sort of thing one. But there's more. There's thing two. Thing two is the thing, because I teach Fourth Amendment law, which is, you know, search and seizure and privacy domestically in the United States. And this is one where Anthropic said they don't want this done because that's just not who they are as a company. They're a private company. They can decide what they want to do. They're not, you know, they're not a company that is, it's not a government entity. And they say, we will not let you use Claude for mass domestic surveillance.
Right.
And in discussing that, they said something very chilling that was dear to me because I teach this. They said, the law in this area is so far behind what is happening on the ground. And you don't understand how much information is out there that people can buy, access, synthesize, and collect and use. By the way, if people listening to this should be thinking Elon Musk, Doge. They were like, we are not going to be part of that. We are not going to be part of actual sort of aggregating and synthesizing on a mass level domestic surveillance of Americans. And so to me, that is both as a lawyer thinking about how are we going to protect how to our beginning of our discussion about what Sarah and I are writing about. This issue is how are we going to protect against any government doing this going forward, of doing this kind of using these tools for mass surveillance?
I want to tease two parts out of this, which is really like 1L contracts questions. The dispute here between the government and Anthropic is about uses of Claude, but that's, I mean, that is just a contract dispute, right? It is like, we have a contract with this vendor. This contract has 85 sections, and this is one subsection that we don't like. By the government's logic, could they do the same thing if they didn't like the price? Could they say, you're charging us X, and we are only willing to pay X minus 5, and if you don't give us this at X minus 5, we're going to declare you a supply chain risk? Right. I mean, by substituting other contractual disputes into there, it makes it clear how pernicious this is, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Because the thing that the gun to the head is so irrelevant to there's no correlation to the threat is we can put you out of business if you don't do this. And it's not like the threat is like, oh, you actually have this problem. And so absolutely, they could be like, you're going to give it to us for free.
I mean, isn't that how business works in China? The Chinese Communist Party decides that Jack Ma is no longer allowed to do X. And so his AliExpress hedge fund just disappears because the government has declared it.
This is where the abuse of public service is whether it is happening from Justice Alito and Justice Thomas, whether, as Barb McQuaid likes to say, you know what? You don't get to sort of leverage the powers you have as a public servant to make money. You don't get to leverage these powers to... Yeah, of course, right. But I mean,
this is, somebody should write a book on how to reform all of these things that our laws and regulations have allowed to happen.
I love that.
Ding, ding, ding.
This is good. I love this. This actually is a little bit, can be more complicated, but the key to your point is that the threat, the thing that you are sort of saying we will do, has to be real. It has to relate to the thing that you're asking for. If you said, you know what, because we cannot use it for items A and B, we want to pay less for it. That's legitimate, right? That's like, that's a just negotiation. It's not like, to your point, it's not like we're going to pay less because, you know what? This is mob talk. This is like what the mafia does, which is like, yes, you know, we're going to be your new vendor. And you're like, what do you mean? You're like, do you want to dispute it?
So this is exactly what I was trying to get at, which is that once you have laws which allow the government to designate a company as a supply chain risk, what's to stop the government from doing that in ways which are mob-like, right? And so to this point, the thing which has stopped that is we haven't put mobsters in charge of the government. That's not how it works anymore, right? The whole thing is really on the honor system.
Yes, but the reason it is, so no, you can do what Anthropic did. Anthropic is, I'm bringing a lawsuit and I am making this claim. Now, 2 points. One, you have to have a company that is willing to bring the lawsuit, because as we saw with universities and with law firms, a lot of times, or with CBS, you're like, it's easier for us, even though we don't want to do this. We're just going to pay the money, or we're going to sit silently because it's going to hurt our business too much. And to be fair, they're victims in that situation, but they're really doubling down on sort of not standing up for a principle. And so you can go to court, but you have to be willing to go to court. And there is a huge cost to that. I mean, like, to be fair, I know people listening is going, well, they need to go to court and that's their obligation, but there are costs to that. And you can see it in the way that Anthropic is talking about this. They didn't ask to be, you know, vilified in the poster child. They're a business that has a good product, and they're not looking for this fight. They're just looking to be able to contract the way they want. And just to be fair, they're going, you don't have to use Claude at all. Like, they're not, their lawsuit isn't, have to use Claude under the terms that we say. They're perfectly willing to say, you don't want to use Claude. That's fine. We'll actually help you transition to somebody else. That's fine. But you cannot use it for things that you don't want to. And you can put a gun to her head all you want. The other issue that is interesting is that the decision in this case was based on the First Amendment, and not on sort of the improper designation of somebody as a supply chain risk. And that's because the supply chain risk issue is one where there will be a lot more deference to the government in making that determination.
Right.
And one of the things that we have learned in so many ways in this context and in so many other contexts is that legal doctrine of sort of deference to the government and a presumption of regularity, I think, has to be really rethought.
Yes.
Because that all presupposed normalcy. I've had disagreements with Republican and Democratic administrations. I've worked in so many different ones. And of course, you don't agree 100% with any particular administration, but you know, I remember working on the Enron case during President Bush's term, and the people I reported to, who were politicals, were the most ethical, wonderful people, and that's sort of the way it works, and that's what sort of the legal system assumed that's the world we were in, and so you have these sort of antiquated legal presumptions based on that I think explains why the court had to base the decision on First Amendment principles, where the court has more leeway to be able to weigh in and say you can't do this than to say I'm going to second guess the United States government on supply chain issues, where there's, you know, I think they still wouldn't prevail in this case because there's no evidence, but it's a much harder road to go down.
It's the end of regular order, and I don't know how the legal system and the courts are going to grapple with this over the long term.
Moto Casino, America.
America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
All right. We're going to wrap up today talking a little bit about Robert Mueller, who passed away at 81 on Saturday. A truly great American, a guy who came out of Princeton, volunteered to go to Vietnam, has basically served his country at every term. I never met the guy. My wife worked for him and was close to him and deeply, deeply affectionate for him. Just thought of him as like, you know, the best grandfather she ever had, basically. And you worked very closely with him for years and years. And I don't know, tell us a little bit about the Bob Mueller you knew.
So, you know, it's interesting that you said that your wife was said that, like, the grandfather, what she it can't be the grandfather she never had, but I mean, it's sort of like the thought of him that way and was very affectionate because, you know, his image publicly, because he was basically quite shy, was he could come off as a sort of cool and a little distant or cold, and that's just so not who he was personally, and especially on a one-on-one basis. But before we went on, we were comparing notes, and one of the things that I recounted was, Bob Mueller would have people prepare sort of first drafts of speeches. You know, the director of the FBI had to speak constantly in all sorts of settings. And they would prepare speeches, and Director Mueller took this very, very seriously. But the one thing you could never, ever put into a speech, no matter what circumstance, is the word I. It was not possible. You could argue to the cows come home about.
I would hear this from my wife all the time.
And you'd be like, but director, you just did X. And he is like, take it out. It was not open to discussion. He did not view those speeches about self-promotion in any way, shape, or form. I remember, you know, there were morning meetings of the senior leadership, and I was there just as James Comey took over. And without getting into details, it was the first time I'd ever heard a director of the FBI use the I word, because it just didn't happen under Director Mueller. He was so much about the privilege of public service, and while he held you to such a high standard, and you had to work really, really hard and quickly. One of his favorite phrases was "stop playing with your food," which was, you know, he was just like, you need to. He was very much a man of action, but he wanted it had to be a man of action where like everything was thought through. I mean, it wasn't like, you know, shoot first, you know, think later. It was just he drove himself harder than anyone. And then I'll give you one quick story. When I first worked for him, I was special counsel, and I would get there really early. I'd sort of get there early for what I call agent hours, which was the special agents would get in very early, but I'd have to be there early too. And I would stay to very, very late. I'd stay late, and I'd do lawyer hours. So it was kind of like the worst of everything, because it was just, so I'd be there doing my lawyer hours, and where I was sitting, the director would go by me and say goodnight. And the first time he said goodnight, you know, this is Robert Mueller. He's the Robert Mueller of blue suit, white shirt,
yep,
rep tie. The white shirt was a button down shirt, like, you know, Brooks Brothers button down shirt, which is, that's just like a standard thing. Is, you know,
he was born in it, shine shoes.
Yeah, I
see his baby pictures. He's just the same.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. So I hear like good night, and I look up, and it's Director Mueller, in his spandex biking outfit.
What?
And I'm, because he's like going to bike home with his security detail. And I just remember looking, going, this, don't need to see it. Don't want to see it. Like,
can't unsee it though.
Exactly. Cause I was like, this, it was just such a contrast to, you know, Bob Mueller. But on this serious side, I've been telling various stories about him because it is true, as many people have said, that it feels like a dying breed, and that he was so revered. As I've said it, people in the Department of Justice and in the intelligence community, he was as close to God as you could get. He was just, his reputation was so huge. But that's the thing that I think, as hard as it is to have him no longer be here, I do think the reason I don't think it's sort of like a passing of the guard is there are so many people who hold his model inside them. Like you were saying, what your wife thinks of him. Mary McCord and I were talking about how much his example meant to us. And we're not alone. We're not unique. I mean, that is, I can't think of anyone who knew him, worked with him, or just knew him by reputation who doesn't have that feeling and doesn't try and live up to the example he set. So that part, I think, really, again, I know I'm ending on a you think, but you're going to go back and tell Sarah, this guy is really naive.
Not at all.
I really do think that that model is something that is deep inside the career people who have worked in government or still work in government.
Just a final word about him for people who may be younger than you and I, who may not really remember the post 9/11 years. It isn't just that Mueller was a selfless guy and a good guy. He was also tremendously competent. And he oversaw the utter transformation of the Bureau. So he was, you know, he had been on the job for what? 2 weeks before 9/11 or something like that?
1 week.
1 week.
1 week.
He took over as a prosecutor who was there running an agency which was out catching criminals and got tasked with turning this thing into a counterterrorism organization. It is, I mean, the history of organizational transformation is littered with things gone wrong, especially when you have to hire up quickly. And we saw that, I mean, Garrett Graff wrote an entire book about this with the Border Patrol. We have seen it happen with DHS. It's really, really hard to transform organizations. And he did it in ways that were, I mean, it worked. We didn't have any domestic terror incidents during his watch after 9/11 when everybody thought it was coming, right? And the FBI did incredible work and managed to walk and chew gums at the same time, right?
I mean, there were smaller domestic terrorism events, like the Boston bombing happened.
Right. But not like organized, right? We didn't have Al-Qaeda attacks.
No, absolutely. And that was number one. That was the number one thing on his mind more than anything.
And people may not remember that that's what that world was like, but that is what, I mean, 2002, 2003, that was everything.
So I just want to foot stomp up one thing you said about confidence, because, you know, we see the one thing that, regardless of politics, there's no one who can really say, oh, Pete Hegseth, he's definitely the best person for that job. Right. Or Kash Patel, he's definitely the best person for that job, meaning he has the best, most experience for it. And this is why why competence is just so unbelievably important. So I get to the Bureau and you get to see the Presidential Daily Brief every day. You're reading it. And the first like week that you're exposed to that, It is a very, very scary thing because it's got all of the pages and pages of threat streams. And what was remarkable is watching Director Mueller, the deputy director, the head of the National Security Division, focus on to see why they're focusing on particular ones. Everything had to be looked at. There's no, it wasn't like they weren't going to follow everything, but you have to do triage as to what's most important. And I remember asking Director Mueller later, why this and why not that? Like, how is that made? Because that's the skill set. And he remember him saying it in this day and age of big data, the issue is not going to be that we don't have something in our file somewhere that could be a lead or could be the red flag. It's being able to see it and to recognize it. That's good. That is going to be the art form. That is the skill. It's not that it's happening and no one knows anywhere. There will be something. And it's being able to do that. And that comes with an enormous amount of experience of what these things look like and having that sense of what seems most dire and most imminent. And, you know, I felt so lucky that the people I was seeing making those triage choices Bob Mueller was there not because of politics. He'd served in Republican and Democratic administrations. Yeah. He'd been appointed by Republicans and Democrats. And he was so smart and so dedicated. And I felt that way about the people he had appointed beneath him to be doing this. And to me, that I can never, ever bring myself to understand how, if you have been president of the United States and you have seen the PDB, how the number one thing that you would look for is not loyalty, it is that experience to be able to do that triage, because it is, we are living in, like, you know, ostriches in the sand if we do not think there are those risks. You know, we just had an attack on Venezuela. We're at war with Iran. You don't think that we are making ourselves a sort of vilified across the globe, and that there aren't going to be repercussions that the CIA and the FBI and the NSA and other parts of the intelligence community are going to need to be vigilant on? That is the consequences that we need to be prepared for. And I don't see that level of expertise being put in place or being valued. Quite the opposite.
I mean, you know, Bob Mueller was great and all, but did he ever host a podcast? Something to think about.
You know, God,
we literally have podcast hosts running these places now.
Anyway, I will miss him.
Andrew, thank you for being with me.
Yeah.
May his memory be a blessing to you. I hope I wasn't too bad of a substitute for Sarah. Sarah Longwell will be back next week. You will not have to put up with
you
unless Andrew and I really do become best friends. And we'll be back next week. Hit like, hit subscribe, follow the channel. It helps us a lot. And if you want to leave us a comment, pop in the comments and I'll try to stop in and say hi too.
Take care.
John Daly here. You know what day it is? Neither do I. I live life daily. That's why I only spend on Moto Casino. Moto's got daily free bonuses, daily tournaments, new slots added daily. And the best part? Guaranteed daily jackpots. You can't beat that. So today's the day you grip it and spin it with me on Moto. America's social casino. Play for free on Moto.us.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Download the Moto Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.